Welcome, everybody. Good evening. Can you all hear me okay? Hi. Hello. My name is Madeline Keep, and I'm Curator of Public Programmes here at Tate Modern. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome you all to this evening's talk with artist Nick Woplington. Before we start, a bit of housekeeping. Just so that you know, the loos are just over here. We are audio recording tonight's talk, and Nick's very kindly said he's happy to take a few questions if you have them at the end. I'm holding the microphone now, and we'll be walking around with it when we get to questions, so that we capture it, so that we can all hear each other, and for the recording, if you could wait for the microphone, that would be great. If you could also just take a minute to check that your phones are on silent. And while you do that, on your chairs are an evaluation form. That is about tonight's event, but it's also about your interests and things that you would like to see happening at Tate Modern in our events programme. So if you could take a minute at the end to fill that out and share your thoughts, then we'd be very grateful. So this evening, Nick will be talking about the work that he's got on display in conflict time photography, but he'll be also talking about a significant project titled Settlement, which the theme of relates very much to conflict and time. Settlement is a collection of images presented as a photo book, which was recently published by MacBooks. That are images that were taken by Nick whilst he lived in Jerusalem between 2008 and 2013. During this period, he visited over 350 distinct Jewish settlements in the region. And this book's title refers to the Jewish communities built in the region of the former state of Palestine, known as the West Bank, an area of approximately 2,173 square miles between the Jordan River and Jerusalem. The book investigates the topology of Jewish identity in the West Bank. Settlement is part of a project entitled This Place, an exhibition project, which explores the complexity of Israel and the West Bank through the eyes of 12 internationally acclaimed photographers. This place was formerly in Prague, and it opens in Tel Aviv in May. To give a little bit of a further introduction to Nick, he's a British photographer born in Yemen and based in London and New York. He's published a number of photo books, including Living Room in 1991, Safety in Numbers in 1996, and Settlement in 2014. He's exhibited internationally with solo shows such as Double Dactyl, Whitechapel Gallery in 2007, group shows including the 49th International Venice Biennial in 2001. And Nick received the ICP Infinity Award in 1993, and his photographs can be found in many public collections, including the Guggenheim, MoMA in New York, and the V&A, and the Government Art Collection here in London. So now I would like to hand over to Nick to begin our lecture. Thank you.
Is this on? Hi. Hello. Firstly, I'd like to say thank you for coming. And I will be checking your evaluation form, so make sure you write good things about me, otherwise I'll be contacting you afterwards. Okay, here we go. I'm hoping it's going to go in the right direction. We're here to talk about Alexander McQueen. I've just been hanging this at Tate Britain today, so this is kind of on my mind, which is a work that I've made simultaneously with the work in Israel. So there's kind of very disparate work, but anyway, that's that. So moving swiftly on, where to start? I haven't rehearsed this. Basically, for me, this work started about 25 years ago. I was in South Africa towards the end of apartheid, and I contacted David Goldblatt, and because I very much wanted to meet him because I liked his work, and he suggested that I join him on a car journey from Cape Town to Johannesburg, which is about a 12-hour journey, and I could ask him whatever I wanted along the way. And I was kind of a precocious young man, and during the journey, I was talking to him about his work in Boksburg. I don't know if anyone is aware of this work, but this work deals with an Afrikaner community on the outskirts of Johannesburg. And I was kind of interested about why he made the work and how he came to want to photograph an Africana community. And he told me that even though he didn't agree with their views or how they lived, he felt a kind of sympathy for the people as people, and he wanted to create a work that had a kind of humanity that dealt with them as people. And he thought that by making this work, he could kind of get under the skin of why that they lived the life that they did and why they believed what they believed. And when I was invited to go to Israel and the West Bank for the first time in 2007, as I was traveling around, I started to think about Mr. Goldblatt and his reasons for wanting to work with Afrikaners. And I specifically asked to go and meet settlers in the West Bank. And the first kind of reaction was, you know, why do you want to do that? And the settlers were like, no one is interested in us. Everyone hates us. Why do you want to take pictures? And I was kind of, that kind of gave me enough reason to want to make the work. I think, you know, with what is termed kind of concerned documentary art photography, it's extremely easy to find subject matter that deals with the kind of the downtrodden or the dispossessed, and there's a kind of stereotypical kind of formula that people use when they make documentary photography. And what I wanted to do was try and kind of flip that and see if I could actually find a positive dynamic within dealing with what I would concede to be people who had views that were very different to mine, that were kind of the other, as it were. So I set out to make a set of very humanistic pictures that try to kind of strip away the contextualization of the conflict, as it were. This picture is a family in a settlement called Tekoa Dalid, which is on the edge of the Jordan Valley. And for me, the space on the other far side of the tree represents the Palestinians. They have very little contact with the Palestinians in a lot of these settlements. So what I wanted to do was kind of remove the conflict from the photographs and strip things down to the kind of essence of the landscape and of the people. Now this is the Kidron Valley, which is right next to the old city in Jerusalem. So these six pictures, you see the whole of the Kidron Valley, which kind of includes the old city of Jerusalem. You can see the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the third picture at the top. And then you move through the Palestinian village of Silwan and down the Kidron Valley towards the Dead Sea. Now, within this is the most contested place in the West Bank. This is supposedly where the world is going to end. And also the Silwan here, this village, is slated for demolition. The mayor of Jerusalem wants to demolish these buildings and build the City of David Park and shopping mall here. Now, within the Palestinian communities that live here, there are a number of settlements. This building here is a building called Beit Yonatan, which is built illegally, where the six settler families are guarded by about 200 police and soldiers all the time. And this building is an illegal building. So while I was there, I was kind of meeting people and kind of investigating the landscape and taking portraits of mainly Anglo-Jews. I found that a lot of the inhabitants of the West Bank had made aliyah, they were Jews from the Jewish diaspora who had moved to Israel the West Bank for various different reasons, and a lot of them are Anglophone. This family are from Canada. I was trying to take very, very kind of straightforward formal portraits of the inhabitants. So this is actually a close-up of Beit Yonatan and Silwan. You can see the building just here with the Israeli flag on it is the settlement, and it's completely surrounded by Palestinian housing. The flag's gone now, but the building is still there. I was very lucky that it was a very kind of calm time that I was there, and I was able to move very freely around the West Bank while I was making the work. This is East Jerusalem. This picture is taken from a settlement called Nof Zion, which is built in East Jerusalem, and this is looking across the valley to the wall. You can see the separation barrier that separates Abu Dis from East Jerusalem itself. And these are school children coming home from school in the afternoon. Arab school children. And this is Nof Zion itself, the settlement that's built also in the Kidron Valley. This is an Orthodox family in the settlement of Alon Shvut. Often I would take the pictures, would be taken on a Friday afternoon. It was the kind of the only time that people were free. And I was kind of very interested in finding out, you know, why people were there, whether their reasons were political, whether their reasons were religious, or whether they actually, and I came away with a kind of understanding that people's reasons for being there were kind of extremely hybrid and extremely different. I met one family where the guy lived in New Jersey, and the mountain biking was better in the West Bank. And he put on lots of weight, and he was like, I can rent out my house in New Jersey, I can live here, I can go mountain biking every day, and I don't have to work, you know. He just happened to be Jewish, so he was able to do that. I mean, so I went there with this kind of idea that that people would have a kind of political and religious reasons only for making Aliyah and living in the West Bank, and that turned out not to be the case. I also found there were a lot of young families were completely priced out of living in Jerusalem, because the Haradi, the ultra-Orthodox, buy up most of the property, and the only way that they can afford to live in the Jerusalem area is to live in a settlement. So this is Ramot, which is one of the first settlements built after the 67 war. Basically, that they built a whole line of settlements just over the Green Line very, very quickly along the outskirts of Jerusalem and around down towards Tel Aviv. And this is Ramot. And the perception of people within Jerusalem and often within Israel is that this is not a settlement. This is what they call, you know, facts on the ground, that this has been there a long time. And even though it's on the other side of the Green Line, people wouldn't actually perceive this to be a settlement anymore. They just consider it to be part of Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem was annexed to Israel in 1980 by the Israelis. But, you know, so this couple are, they're refuseniks. The Russians who made Aliyah to Israel, the West Bank, in the 1970s, and they're very much a group that are extremely separate from the Russians who moved there in the 1990s. They can these people went through kind of extreme hardship in the former Soviet Union to get permission to leave and go and live in Israel. And there are three very distinct settlements close to Tel Aviv where they live as a group. There's also a couple of Spanish-speaking settlements with Uruguayans and Argentinians. And things are very much kind of defined in that way, that every settlement has a kind of unique kind of, I don't know, demarcation. There are some where they basically still speak English. There are some where they're Spanish. Some that are a mixture of Orthodox and secular, and some that are just secular. So what I was hoping to do was just kind of slowly build up a kind of picture of Jewish settlement in the West Bank by visiting as many of the settlements as I could. And photographing them, and photographing the landscape and the infrastructure. This is the light railway system in Jerusalem, which has been added in the last 4 or 5 years, which basically runs along the old green line and basically cuts the city in half. But this is the yard where they keep the trains, which is in East Jerusalem, and you can see the wall running there. The separation barrier is here. But the separation barrier itself is interesting. It's constantly moving. It's not a fixed. It's not a fixed thing. It's not in one place and then it kind of stays there. They're often tearing it down and rebuilding it and putting it somewhere else. And there are people challenging it for various different reasons the whole time. This is an American family in Tekoa again. One thing that I found out is there's always a reason why they're building a settlement in a particular place. And one of the reasons is if there was a biblical Jewish settlement there, then they would build a settlement there. But there's one settlement they built because a soldier was shot there by the Palestinians. So they're like, fuck you, we'll build a settlement here. And it's actually in the middle of nowhere. There's absolutely no reason for it to be there at all. And I know that very few people live there, but if the UN are coming, they bus people in, and so that the houses all look like they're lived in when the UN come round. And I know quite a few people are kind of ready to be bussed around whenever necessary. This is the first settlement that was built after the war in the northern West Bank near Nablus. And Chevne Shamron, I thought I'd forgotten the name, but yeah, this is Chevne Shamron. And these are the original units that were built there. Originally, people were living in a railway station that was part of the railway that went from Cairo to Damascus. Kind of crazy to think you used to be able to go on the train from Cairo to Damascus, but you could, yeah. So this is the Dead Sea Valley. In the Dead Sea Valley, there are a number of kibbutzes that were Jewish-owned and Jewish-ran until 1948, when they were evacuated. And after 67, people went back to the kibbutzes again and started them again. They say that the land was rightfully theirs, that they'd purchased it legally, and therefore, you know, that they should be there. I can't remember the name of this one, actually, off the top of my head. It's very close to the Highway 1 and the Dead Sea. This is an Australian family that live in Malay Adumim. This guy, who's from Melbourne, he basically operates front companies where he works with Palestinians to set up front companies, which then purchase houses from Palestinians via, and once they get hold of the property, then they house settlers in the property. And that's what he does, you know. So they go through. There's a really kind of elaborate ruse where they find Palestinians who are living in the United States or Canada, and they offer them large sums of money to go back and say they want to return, and they're looking for land to buy, and they buy houses, and then they kind of disappear into the ether again, and then suddenly he's got the houses and he can house settlers in them, and he's funded by a guy called Herman Muscovitz who. Herman Muscovitz runs bingo in hospitals in California, and he has some kind of foundation. It's called like Freedom for Change or some kind of bullshit like that. And basically, it's a non-profit organization. It's a non-taxable kind of charity, and all of the money from that goes to buy property and land in the West Bank. So this is an outpost. So basically, you know, the way that settlements start is, you know, with an outpost. And there can be various different reasons why an outpost starts. And one of the main reasons is telephone masts. They want telephone masts on hills so they can have good network coverage. And Orange Telecom, the French company, or EE as they're now called, they're the main provider of cell phone networks in the West Bank. So as soon as they've got a telephone mast, it needs protecting. So therefore, they can put some caravans up, and then the caravans are there, so they need water. So then they have the water supply, the telephone mast, the caravans, and then what they do is they start to build walls around the caravans. And then suddenly there's a kind of caravan with breeze blocks around it, and then they take the caravan out from the middle. It's kind of bizarre. But there is a point where they can ask for the outpost to be deemed legal, and once the outpost is legal, it changes from being an outpost to a settlement. But these things are not very clearly defined. I think that, you know, and often there are a number of left-wing kind of Israeli judges who kind of ask them to be torn down or whatever. It's a kind of constant battle of subterfuge and weird games that I understand certain parts of it, but it's continually going on. They're going up, they're coming down. The only way you could really kind of find them all was to fly an aeroplane over the West Bank. But you're not allowed to do that anymore. Those small aircraft are banned from flying over there. So I got to know the roads very well and the dirt track networks across the West Bank. And then I would come across places that had come up, you know, literally like weren't there 2 weeks before, but they were suddenly there. And then you go back a month later and they'd be gone, or sometimes they had grown. And, you know, things are kind of constant. It was a kind of constantly changing landscape, really, with the housing. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of them are young people. It kind of, it's a kind of game of cat and mouse with the IDF. And the Palestinians are kind of very kind of stoic. A lot of the time, they would just kind of shrug their shoulders and let them kind of get on with it. This is Pizzagot. So what the city you can see here is Ramallah. This settlement was built to stop the western spread of Ramallah. So they're trying to kind of confine Ramallah by building settlements around it. So right next to this, the Palestinians built an enormous soccer field. So there's this big soccer stadium right next to this. So which the settlement are trying to have it knocked down. So this is the view down into Ramallah from what is ostensibly a kind of ultra-Orthodox Haredi settlement. And it's very strange when you're standing there because they're looking at each other through the windows. So they can like see in each other's windows. But there is no, they never meet. This is an Argentinian family. So they like to barbecue. So, and this is in Bataan, which is a fairly militant settlement in the Gush Etzion region, which is kind of notorious for having a group of kids who are in a kind of paramilitary unit called the Hilltop Youth, who they bombed a Palestinian girls' school in Jerusalem about 15 years ago. So they're kind of fairly notorious. And they don't have a perimeter fence because they're all kind of tooled up and ready to go. And I don't know what to say now about this place. It's the most beautiful place, but the people are kind of crazed. This is another outpost. This is a kibbutz called Galit, which is in the northern West Bank, overlooking Jordan. And there's a biblical significance to this hill, which I'm not quite sure has something to do with fires on the lunar calendar or something. Do you know? You don't know? No, I can't remember. I did know. This is E1. E1 is the last piece of open land between East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And this building in the center there is the new headquarters of the Jerusalem police. So this is the piece of land that the Palestinians see as their only possibility of having a viable state in East Jerusalem, because this is the open land that links them to Jerusalem. And after, I think it was last year or the year before, when they asked for recognition by the UN, this is where Netanyahu said he's going to build next. So they're going to close this off. Once this land here is built on, then basically East Jerusalem will be circled by development and cut off. I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, they're kind of building everywhere else. This is Shavut Rachel, which is a settlement in the northern West Bank. I'm trying to take kind of just very simple pictures of the landscape there as well. You know, it's kind of extremely dull and very mundane, but also extremely beautiful as well. And this is just one of the towns in that part of the northern West Bank. This is a synagogue, a temporary synagogue that they are building and on Palestinian land just outside the settlement, and basically the IDF are pulling it down and they're rebuilding it again, and it's just going on and on and on for years in this location. It's a kind of game of cat and mouse. This is Shadima, which was a military base overlooking Bethlehem. And the settlers got in there, and they were, you know, it's a very strategic location, and they opened a settlement there, and they were putting street signs from Jerusalem to get there, and they were kind of trying to get it recognized, but the IDF went in and basically removed them all and decided to pull the army base down. And I got in there during the demolition and took this picture during the demolition. This is an American family. And this is Ovnat, which is very close to the Dead Sea. This is kind of strategic position halfway along the Dead Sea Valley Road. This is the place where it's kind of 45 to 50 degrees during the day in the summer. They don't come out of the huts. They're like, it's quite nice in the winter, but there's no reason for this place to be there at all. None whatsoever, you know. This is a family in the South Hebron Hills, quite a well-known settler family. The chap with the bird, his was involved in a terrorist gang with his brother, who was killed by the Palestinians. And they live in a wood, and they're quite kind of notorious. I was trying for a long time to get to photograph them. I didn't think they'd do it. But in the end, after kind of persistence, after I'd been there a few years, they allowed it. Bye. Okay, cracking on. So what we have here, we have the bridge there was built after the First Intifada. Before the First Intifada, to get to the Southern West Bank, you had to drive through Bethlehem. So they, after the Intifada, they built the tunnel through the mountain and the bridge to connect the Southern West Bank with Jerusalem. And this is Gilo, the settlement on top, which is considered to be part of Jerusalem. And there's a lot more building slated for this area. What you're seeing on the far side of the picture is actually Bethlehem. And during the Second Intifada, they were taking pot shots at each other across that bridge. This is the Mount of Olives and the Israeli flag. At the top there, that's a settlement house. That was a house that belonged to a Palestinian that the Australian chap we saw earlier managed to get hold of. And the guy who sold the house to the settlement organization just made the mistake of coming back to the West Bank and was pulled from his car and ripped apart in Jericho about 2 years after this. So really, and they're very proudly flying the Israeli. You go to the outside of the house and it's just like a fort around it. It's the only Jewish property in a sea of Palestinian buildings, this one. And it overlooks, you know, the Mount of Olives. This This is a Bedouin camp in the first picture. These are three views of the same area, and this is the last open space between Jerusalem and Bethlehem that hasn't been built on, and they're planning 2,000 units here, and there's these kind of couple of Bedouin families that are kind of hanging on, and the caravans from the 1990s when they put a kind of caravan park there to house families from the Soviet Union. I think about 1 million people moved from the Soviet Union to Israel in the 1990s, and they were housing them there for the first few years. And I think there's two or three families left in the Bedouin, but it's just about to be built on, And this is the end sequence of the book. This is Ha-Huma, which means believe concrete wall, which was an olive grove that looked over Bethlehem. You could stand in Manger Square and you could look down across apparently quite this kind of beautiful hill of olive trees. And now there's this settlement there, which is actually considered to be part of Jerusalem, and with the six pictures here, you get the sweep through the settlement and then down the valley towards Bethlehem. And this is kind of a horrific ecological disaster, if nothing else, as the water table is being destroyed and the housing units are, I wouldn't say, very kind of sympathetic to the landscape. We'll stay with this for a second. So with this work, I was trying to kind of build up a kind of topographic of both the landscape and the people and try and keep it as kind of simplistic as I could so people could kind of bring their own interpretation to the pictures and what is going on. I didn't want to kind of be overtly political within the work itself, but obviously the things that I've been saying to you now are kind of quite the opposite. But I felt that when I was making the work, if I kind of got into these kind of arguments, then I would kind of go off in a number of kind of hybrid directions and the work would fail. So that is the settlement book, and I'm going to move on. I made a lot of work while I was there, and I'm still making some work now. And I'm going to move on to this, which was a small project that I made simultaneously, called The Patriarch's Wardrobe. I was interested in what was happening I kept seeing waste lorries in the South Hebron Hills, and I kind of followed them one day, and I found the landfill where the settlers' waste was being taken, and there's a text I wrote at the beginning of the book, which you can read, and then I'll move on. I'll tell you more about the. So, people read it? No. Is this interesting? So I got there, and I felt when I saw the piles of waste, they kind of reminded me a little bit of the piles of shoes at Auschwitz. I persuaded the nice people at Veolia, who collect the waste in the West Bank, to allow me onto the site. And the waste is worked by Bedouin, mainly by children, who scavenge through the settlers' waste looking for things of value that they can recycle. Primarily metal, but anything of value that they can. And they just, these kids are just working there in extreme heat, and the smell is kind of horrible. We had like 20 showers, didn't we, every time we left there. So I started to take pictures there. And I made this small book with a small Australian publishing company that no one ever sees because I don't know what the guy's doing, smoking weed or sitting on the beach, but he doesn't do anything to try and sell any of the books. But anyway, so this book was published in Melbourne a couple of years ago. There are some floating around somewhere. So I started to collect things from them, and I started to use them in small paintings of the landscape. The text at the beginning refers to the kind of changing colours of the landscape, and I started to make these small paintings, and I started to try and, with the book, to use the paintings with the photographs. I'm always kind of looking for new ways to fail with photography, you know, new ways of working and new ideas, and trying to kind of push where I'm going with it. I'm not kind of interested in, I don't think that, oh, we'll go on to that in a minute. That I'm not kind of interested in, you know, photography as a kind of something of its own. I'm kind of interested in photography as a part of art and part of a kind of larger art practice. And my art has kind of moved in various different weird directions over the years. And with these pictures, I've been trying to incorporate painting and photography into kind of one project, and with some success and some failure, but it's quite a nice little book. So I thought, you know, we'll show you that. And while I was there, I kind of got involved with various kind of leftist art co-op, and a leftist kind of art co-op in Tel Aviv, and they decided that I should do a show while I was living there. So I did a small show, and I went to see the space, and it was opposite the American Embassy. So I thought I could have a bit of fun. Hence, there's my spoonerism sign, which I stole the sign from the West Bank, and this is the distance to the West Bank from the American Embassy in Tel Aviv if you go via America. So I put this up outside the American Embassy, and it lasted, you know, a good few months before they came and asked them to take it down. But I've shipped it back. It's now safely in my studio in Hackney Wick, so I have it for a rainy day. I don't, you know. Anyway. So moving on, I became kind of, as I got to know more about Israel and the West Bank, I started to find these solar water heaters. In the 1950s, Israel didn't have much access to coal or oil, so an enterprising Israeli developed these kind of solar water heaters that heated these, so they had the panels and these heaters, and everyone had them on their roofs. And at first I was kind of interested in why some of the roofs had black water containers as well as these water heaters and some didn't. And then I found out that the Palestinians don't have water pressure, so they have the black water containers on their roofs. And if you're Jewish, they have water pressure and they don't have the black containers. So you can tell the difference between a Jewish house and a Palestinian house about whether they all have these, but whether they have the black containers or not. And then I would be in some of the settlements, and I would find these with, they fur up, because there's a lot of lime in the water, and they would line them up and use them for target practice. So I started to collect them and put them in the garden of my house in Jerusalem, and I just kind of let them stay there for a while. And then I found the guy who was like collecting them and recycling them and selling them, which was just outside a place called Pisgat Zev. So this is just, you know, by the wall, you can see the separation wall. And he's just finding them, collecting them, and, you know, people buy them to recycle them for various different reasons. And then when I needed more of them, instead of like waiting till I found another one in the settlement, I knew I could go to him and for 100 shekels I could get another one. Anyway, so what I did, I decided that I wanted to make work with them. So I decided, had those kind of one of those kind of moments when I kind of had a eureka moment. I decided that I would turn them into racing cars. And I get the Palestinians love their cars and racing and horses. And I knew the story of Barak, the Mohammed steed who kind of raced from Mecca to Jerusalem. And when he got there, the only thing that was left were the hooves. So the Palestinians kind of love racing. And they had a horse racing track when the British were there. And then when it became Israel, they closed the horse racing track down. And then they got into cars and they all, you know, they have these kind of souped up old Golfs. And so I found this guy here who had a body shop in the Abu Dis refugee camp. And I just went to him and I was like, well, I know these water heaters, I want you to turn them into racing cars for me. So the first one I gave him, I said, just spray it like you spray the cars. And, you know, that's what I want. And I came back and he painted it black and he put flames at the bottom. And I thought it was kind of too literal. So I started to make these small models and then he would copy them. And so for the kind of the last couple of years that I was there, I was making these, and these were, this is another one, and then I exhibited these in the public art space in Tel Aviv when I had the show, and they all came from the refugee camp to the show. There they are, some of them. These are all back in London now as well. but I'm just about to make more because I'm having a show in Tel Aviv and these are going to be at the museum and they're going to be in the show. So I'm just about to make a whole, rather than ship all these back again, I'm going to make another set there. So I'm kind of looking forward to going back and working with everyone again. So I wanted to kind of show this. It was my original intention to show these with the settlement pictures, which hasn't happened yet, but maybe, you know, at some point it will happen. Ah, moving on. So finally, I wanted to talk about this, the work that is in the Conflict Time Photography Show, where I'm trying to find the right slide. This is not the version of the PowerPoint the last version, is it? No. Anyway, so there's meant to be, before that one, there's meant to be a catalogue of a show called Krieg. I was in a show called Krieg at the Neue Gallery in Graz in Austria in 1993. Krieg means war in German, and Graz is just over the border from the former Yugoslavia. Oh, you've got it. Okay, oh, we're gonna get the latest version. You can see. Anyway, I can carry on talking. But so basically, I was asked to be in this show by the people, Christina Frisengalli and Manfred Willmann at Camera Austria in 1993. And the theme was war, as the war was going on in Yugoslavia. And they thought I was young and foolish and I'd really like to go to Bosnia and check out the war. So I did. I went to Bosnia. I spent a month there. It's kind of quite alarming, really, in many ways. But that's another story. And I got back to the UK after my month in Bosnia, and I went surfing down near Swansea, and my friend said, you know, I've got something I want to show you. And he took me to Barry Island, where these drawings were on the walls of the former POW camp there. And I did a bit of research on the camp, and apparently, you know, they'd held regular soldiers there, and also kind of low-level members of the SS had been held there as well before they were sent to Nuremberg. I'm told that I believe the officers were all held on the Isle of Man. So I thought about these, and I thought, well, you know, I need to photograph them. I was thinking, you know, about the show being in Austria, and I thought it was kind of more important for the Austrians to think about their Nazi past, which they always blame on the Germans, rather than see pictures that I'd taken in Bosnia. So luckily for me, they agreed to it. And let's see if we can... Ah, this is the Krieg catalogue. This is the cover of the catalogue. And this is the show and the Neue Gallery in Graz in 93, when the work was first exhibited. So I exhibited the work there. The prints are about the same kind of size, slightly different framing or whatever. And the title refers is a quote from Conrad from The Heart of Darkness, which I was thinking about today, actually, about, you know, The Heart of Darkness. And someone was saying to me how it's about colonialism. And I was like, no, it's about, you know, it's about a kind of state of mind where there is a kind of mass psychosis being driven by a kind of some kind of psychopath. And I kind of thought about that in terms, you know, of the Nazis and kind of now with ISIS. It's the same kind of thing. It's a kind of, you know, in the heart of darkness, you know, and then, you know, Apocalypse Now. And then with ISIS, it's about death cults, isn't it? You know, so I, so I did the show and then, of course, when the Conflict Time photography show came around, it was kind of a fantastic moment for me to kind of bring the work out again. And I want the work for me is about the kind of, about the imagination and the kind of loneliness and the desperation of the kind of situation. And I wonder about the mindset of the people when they were there in that camp, you know, after the war, and when they were drawing these Bavarian landscapes and the women's haircuts, whether they were kind of indignant. There was meant to be a book of these, which Moral Books were publishing, and he hasn't got his act together and done it, which is a shame. But in the book, I had a really fantastic quote from my granddad, who's 97, and I was asking him, you know, a few years ago about the Second World War, and he's a doctor, and he was telling me about Monte Cassino, and he said that what happened at Monte Cassino is the Poles went in first, and the Nazis, the SS, they surrendered, and the Poles went in, and then they shot them. And then after that, apparently the Anzacs, the New Zealanders, went in, and they didn't take any chances, and they flamethrowered the rooms as they went through the monastery from room to room. They were flamethrowing them. And so when my granddad, who was a doctor, you know, went into the room, he went into a room and there was an SS officer on the floor who had like 80% burns, and he went to inject him with painkiller. And the guy said to my granddad in German, he said, an SS officer feels no pain. And my granddad said, but I do. And he injected him. And I've got that quote from my granddad at the front of the book if it ever happens. And I was kind of thinking about that. And I felt that it's a kind of really quiet work. And I've watched people actually in the show. I've been here a few times, and people kind of seem very kind of quizzical and kind of move past it very fast. But for me, it's a kind of a kind of really important piece of work, really. I don't know what else I can. This is great, the POW porridge. I thought this was too obvious. Back in 93, and then this time I thought, no, I'm going to use this one. There's something about it that I like. But this, the landscape, this one is my kind of favourite, I think. I always wonder if these are bullet holes in the wall. Right. So that, I believe, is kind of an hour, and I'm happy to take questions about this or anything else, or, you know, that we would want me to talk about. I hope that was interesting. You know, it's the first time I've talked publicly about any of these works, so I'll kind of get better at it, hopefully, but yeah.
Thanks very much. I thought it was very fascinating. My question is about the first work you showed us about the settlers.
Yes.
I don't know how you present it, but is it presented with any testimony from the settlers or any commentary from you? Because looking at those photographs is fascinating from a sort of, you know, from any kind of viewpoint, but I kind of feel you're giving them slight oxygen or some kind of publicity or celebrating their success in their terms, in their quotes. I mean, I don't see it as a success, but they obviously do to survive in that scenario. So the question is whether you present it in a way which is critical of what they're doing. And the second point is really, have you had any feedback from them, or have you had any negative publicity as a result of doing those photographs from the sort of right-wing state that Israel is?
It's interesting. I mean, first of all, I started off, I wrote about 25,000 words of kind of packed, you know, of information about the situation with the settlers in the West Bank. And I just realized that I could go on forever. And also the situation there is changing all the time. And I didn't want the work to become kind of locked down in a moment. And I do, but if the work was not, if it didn't have a kind of humanity to it, the work would not be viable to show to the Jewish community in the United States, and they are the most important people to view the work in many ways, because if any change is going to come, it's going to come from them. And I could see that some people might consider the work to be possibly kind of considered to be kind of pro-settler, but also just the fact that the landscapes and what they are and the kind of everything is kind of noted. I don't see it. I try to make the work as kind of accessible as possible, because there's already a lot of work that's being made by kind of photojournalists, which is kind of very pro-Palestinian and very much about the conflict. And what I was trying to do was remove the conflict from the pictures to try and make a kind of subtler work. And I hope that, you know, within that, that the work is able to, will, the dynamic of the work will change over time. And one thing that I would say is that I think that this is my own personal view. The idea of the two-state solution is absolute nonsense. It's a game that's being played by the State of Israel and by their supporters in the West, and is adhered to by the Palestinian leadership, because they're all being blackmailed one way or another. And the actual longer game is one state. And I think that if you talk to ordinary Palestinians on the ground and you talk to settlers, they agree with that. And I think that the only way that that is going to come about, and I really ultimately believe that that is what will happen, is that people are able to view each other in a kind of more humane way. And I feel that my work addresses the situation from the standpoint of viewing the situation in that way, if that makes sense. What was the second part? Sorry. I've had no reaction at all from the State of Israel, but I know that I was being watched while I was making the work. I have various things that I know about that were going on. I've had both pro and anti statements from the people in the photographs. I wrote some paragraphs of facts that appeared in Aperture magazine with the pictures that they were kind of up in arms about, especially about the Bet Yonatan settlement in Silwan, which they disagreed with. I've also had positive reactions. I've had a lot of positive reactions from Palestinians, and the people working with Peace Now and Beth Selim, who have all been very positive about the work, because I've been able to make a work that they needed to see that they are not able to make, because they're not able to get access to especially the more right-wing settlements. I mean, they're difficult places to get into. And I have a lot more work than is in the book as well, which they have access to. So it's a difficult one. And as I was saying at the beginning, we're talking about David Goldblatt and working with the Afrikaners. So what you have there is those pictures were made now over 30 years ago. And you look at that book and you look at how he dealt with them with sympathy. And, you know, they're not, you know, in my terms, kind of particularly nice people. And I think that that is an important part of South African history that he dealt with, that wouldn't have been dealt with within an art context if he hadn't have done it. And even, and I think that it's important as a kind of photo-based artist that you're able to confront really difficult subject matter in a kind of sympathetic and kind of concerned way instead of in a kind of sensationalistic way. And that's what I was trying to do with those pictures, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Hiya, thanks very much. That was incredibly interesting. Just, you alluded to it when you were talking, but also now as you've answered that question, your work, you wanted it to be impartial, and if anything, you were going for the non-underdog. But when you were talking, you portrayed some form of judgment. You showed us your opinion. How do you, when you were doing that work, how do you separate it? How do you go and meet these people, gain their trust, and not show any judgment?
It was difficult. I mean, obviously, the whole time that I was, the first couple of years, really, they were trying to catch me out constantly. And then they kind of gave up. They realized that was going nowhere. I had hostility from people from the This Place project who were supposedly there to help me, who were very, very untrusting of what I was up to and tried to kind of mess with my working practice. So that was difficult too. But ultimately, how do you kind of do something that is investigative and undercover? Because, I mean, it's not completely, you know, like I was an undercover journalist, but to a certain extent it was like that. I had to be kind of very stoic while I was making the work, and I was there. I had no contact with kind of leftist groups or leftist people in Israel at all. I never went on to demonstrations. I never went to Berlin. I never did, you know, I was kind of very careful about that. But ultimately, I didn't feel that I would make a work that kind of put, you know, that was disrespectful to them as human beings. And people, you know, are products of their environment and their situations. There are young people that I know from those settlements who've been taken there to live there by their parents, who I'm friends with, who that's what's happened to them. I'm not, you know, there are people that I know there that I'm friendly with, you know, they're young people, and I know, you know, one young man that I became friends with and I taught with, and he's left Israel. He now lives in Finland, and he grew up in an extremely right-wing settlement, and for him to be able to do that has been extremely challenging, and I felt like, you know, I was, you know, a catalyst for that to a certain degree. But it is difficult, you know, but if you're trying to deal with subject matter that is controversial and kind of edgy, it's always going to be tough. But then at the same time, the picture of the building site at the end where they built on the orange grove, I showed that to a settler that I know, and he's like, "That's amazing." He said, "Look at the yeshuv. Yeshuv is like villages. You know, one day the whole of the West Bank will be covered with yeshuv, and that means the Messiah will be coming quicker." He just thought it was absolutely wonderful. They see every act of building there as making the land ready for the Messiah to come if they're religious. And if they're not religious, then, you know, as I say, the reasons for being there can be purely economic. Just simply that they people who have a job in Jerusalem and the ultra-Orthodox buy up all the housing that comes for sale in Jerusalem en masse. They have a pool of money. They buy it all. And if you've got a young family and you have a job in Jerusalem, you can afford to live in a settlement that's secular, that's just, you know, inside the West Bank. And people say, oh, I'm not really that keen about living here. But, you know, supposedly one day there might be one state, or if there's a land swap, this is an area that will be in a land swap. And they kind of justify it. You know, they've got children and they want the children to have space to run around. It's complex. I went there believing very much in the two-state solution, and I kind of, after a year or so, I realized that was kind of a nonsense. The West Bank is the biblical land of Israel. It's not the swampy plain where Tel Aviv is, where the Philistines lived. They're not so interested in that, yeah, ultimately. So they're not going to leave the West Bank. That's not going to happen. So there has to be a new way forward. Or they have to be thrown out. I don't know. But that's not going to happen, is it? Anyway, yeah.
Thank you very much. Can I ask you, the families that you photographed,
yes,
how did you make contact with them, or how did you select them? And the second question is related to the previous question. When you went to see them, what did you tell them you wanted to do? Why were you taking their photograph?
There was a tutor, the Bezalel Art School in Tel Aviv, who was a settler. He took me to meet various families initially who I photographed. His next door neighbor, there was a young woman who I became friendly with, and she worked as a fixer for me, and she would find me families to photograph. I photographed a lot more families than there are in the book. I photographed hundreds of families. I made a few choices with the editing to not have families that were Christian converts, of which there are quite a lot, not to have any of the Peruvians, because there are 6,000 Peruvians living in the West Bank. Their German pastor converted to Judaism and took them all from Peru to the West Bank in the 1980s. And I decided to not have any pictures of the Peruvians either. I tried to deal primarily with Anglo-Jews or families that were refuseniks, and I tried to have a kind of mix of secular and religious. At the end of the day, the pictures that I thought that worked the best within the context of the book. I mean, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make lots of sense. And I was just wondering, when you went to introduce yourself to
them,
what did you say your project was? Why did you want their photographs?
Well, it varied, really, from family to family. I mean, a lot of them didn't ask any questions at all. They were really happy to have a photograph taken of their family, and I would take digital pictures as well, which I would write there and then download onto their family computer, and they were really happy with them. And then, they weren't particularly, you know, for them it was a kind of interesting to meet someone from England and have their picture taken by a professional photographer. I mean, as simple as that. There were some families that I got to know who were more interested in the project and the dynamic of the project. And I still know and am in contact with them now. And I will see them when I go back there in April. There's a kind of whole cross section, and of interest or lack of interest in both the work and the project. I mean, it's kind of easy if you're kind of art educated to kind of think about things from in a kind of art thinking way, but that's not how the general population think. You know, they're, especially if you're living in the West Bank and in a kind of isolated community. You know, and you left America 20 years ago, It's very insular and very cut off in a way that I didn't really understand, you know. There's obviously, if you're in Israel, there's English language TV, radio, newspapers. You don't have to actually interface with you know, the Western media at all. And so your world can become very, very, very insular, you know.
Yeah, hi. Just out of curiosity, did you make any work in Bosnia?
Yes, I did, yes.
Whatever happened to that?
It's there with all the thousands of other projects and like millions of negatives that, you know, I would like maybe to try and sift through at some point, you know. But it's, you know, it's...
It was never published?
It was never published, okay. No. No, it's never been published, yeah. I'd say I've got, you know, I must have 15 unpublished projects at least, you know, major ones and then smaller ones. You know, I'm constantly at it, so, you know. It's there, you know. But I really kind of felt like that this work was really what came out of that trip, you know, for me. Anyone else? No? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Nick, and thank you, everyone, for coming. As you know, Conflict Time Photography is still on, and it's here until the 15th of March. If you haven't had a chance, then you've got a time to see it this evening. We're open until 10 o'clock. Nick mentioned at the beginning that he's doing a very different project, or we're presenting a very different project at Tate Britain, which is Nick Woppington and Alexander McQueen Working Process, which opens next week. So that's a very different project, but if you'd like to see more from Nick's work, then please do go and see that too. But thank you again for coming. Please do give us your thoughts, and thank you all again. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.